Okay, so I guess we can start. Welcome everyone. Tonight I'm going to talk about Buddhist governance, Buddhist leadership, that sort of thing. You may wonder perhaps how do the monks come up with the topics for these talks? And basically the way that these topics arise is just what is happening in the world or what is happening in our life. And we'll just talk about those things. That's basically how these things happen. Sometimes we get requests for particular talks, but a lot of the time it's just whatever is happening in our lives. One of the things that has been happening recently, if you have been following the news a little bit, is of course, and this has also been quite prominent here for the Buddhist society, and that has been the passing away and the cremation of the King of Thailand, which you may have caught in the news. Quite a big news item, I think. And of course, the King of Thailand was a very important person as far as Buddhist governance is concerned, because he tried to run Thailand for such a long period of time based essentially on Buddhist principles. So this is one thing, one of the reasons for looking at Buddhist governance. The other one is, of course, the events that we've been seeing in Myanmar, with the problems with the Rohingyas and the military government over there. That's another aspect, another side of governance. And one of the questions there is ask ourselves, what is the Buddhist kind of influence there? What has Buddhism got to do with the things that are happening in Myanmar? So I think we can learn something from that as well, looking at some of the negative examples perhaps, and see what comes of that. But more generally, the idea of governance, I think, is actually important for all of us to some extent, because governance comes into life whether we like it or not. It comes into how we run our Buddhist monasteries. It comes into how we run the Buddhist society. It comes into how we run our families, our workplaces, and everything like that. So I think it is important. It's hard to avoid these issues in anyone's life. You don't have to be king or a prime minister for governance to matter. It matters pretty much to everyone. So to look at this, I want to start to look a little bit at Buddhist history, some of the examples of Buddhist governance in Buddhist history. How do we, going back, all the way back to the time of the Buddha, what happened? What are some of the examples from that time of how things were governed? Of course, the Buddha is an example in his own right because he ran a fairly large organization as well in many ways, called Buddhism, called the monastic order, and called all of these things. So that is obviously a very important example, and I will talk a little bit about that later on probably. But also, some of the examples from the time in India 2,500 years ago are the kings that existed then, because many of the kings already at that time, it seems, were Buddhist, because they became so inspired by hearing the Buddha talk and these things. And one of these kings was a very well-known king at that time, King Bimbisara. For those of you who have a Buddhist background, you will know about King Bimbisara for sure. And he was the king of the Magadhan Empire. At this time, it was only a Magadhan state. It was fairly small. But it started off as a small state, just south of the river Ganges. And eventually, it started to develop. And eventually, it kind of engulfed, took up the rest of the north of India around it, gradually over the decade, over a couple of centuries, building up, expanding, taking in pretty much all of India eventually. But it started off as the Magadhan Empire, and the person, the monarch who got this whole thing going, this was King Bimbisara, he started off kind of capturing some of the neighboring states. So he started off not in a very good way. He was a bit dodgy initially, waging a bit war here, killing a few people there. But then one day he meets the Buddha. And when he meets the Buddha the first time, this is before the Buddha has become the Buddha. He's still just the Bodhisattva, trying to find the solution to the problems of life. How is there a solution to the suffering, to death, old age, and all of these kind of things? He's very inspired by this monk, So he says to the Buddha, if you find a solution to these problems of life, please come back again. And then after the Buddha goes to Bodh Gaya, you know, the famous Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha sits down under the Bodhi tree. Yeah, he gained his awakening. Not so long after that, he goes back to see King Bimbisara again. And then King Bimbisara, while listening to a talk given by the Buddha, he becomes a stream enterer, a Sotapanna. Yeah. So a Sotapanna, of course, what that means in Buddhism is somebody who has understood the Buddhist teachings in their heart, who has fully recognized through insight what the Buddha's teachings are. Yeah, and what that means is that certain qualities inside of you, they change irrevocably. You become a different person. Your psychology gets turned upside down. And from then on, you have almost perfect morality. In fact, it is said to be perfect morality. But that the exact definition of that is not so important for now. But essentially, you have perfect morality. You also have perfect generosity. Yeah, you have perfect confidence in the teachings of the Buddha because you have seen them for yourself. Yeah, so you have perfect generosity and perfect morality. Imagine being ruled by a king like that, where you have perfect kindness and perfect generosity towards the people under you. Isn't that a beautiful thing? And of course, because that is what happened with King Bimbisara, and because he obviously was very powerful, because he was already ruling a fairly large kingdom, the Magadhan kingdom, he drew a lot of people to the Buddhist teachings. So they also had the opportunity to hear these marvelous teachings and also grow in kindness, grow spiritually, grow in all these qualities that the Buddhist teaching tries to make us develop in our lives. So this is one of the early examples, of Buddhist governance, having a stream enterer as your kind of person in charge. And I think we should have some female stream enterers in the modern world as well. Wouldn't that be cool? Have a few prime ministers here, a few presidents there, a few monarchs here, a few whatever to be stream. That would be really nice. I think the world would really, really prosper as a consequence. The kindness and generosity coming from the top. And this is one of those interesting things that I think most of us recognize to be true. When things come from the top, when morality, generosity, kindness, all of these things, when they come from the top, they tend to trickle down in society. Yeah, we very often take our cues from leadership, because leadership is also often authority, and because of that, we take our cues from that, so things tend to trickle down. So when you have monarchs, who are stream enterers, when you have prime ministers who are stream enterers, you look and think, wow, I've got to live up to the same kind of standard. Or it naturally happens because we take our cue from leaders. And in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha, it says precisely this. It says that when the kings, or prime ministers or presidents or whatever you have, when they are righteous, then those people who are in connection with them, the vassals, the lower kings or whatever, they too become righteous. When those vassal kings become righteous, then the Brahmins and householders, this is like the establishment in ancient Indian society, those people who were kind of important for that society, they too become righteous. In other words, moral. And when they are moral, basically that affects the whole society, and everyone else becomes moral as a consequence. So it trickles down. Sometimes you hear about trickle down economics. Not everybody believes in trickle-down economics. I think myself, sometimes I wonder whether it really works that way. It looks more like trickle-up economics to me sometimes. However you look at that, trickle-down morality, I think, is a far safer bet than trickle-down economics. It does trickle down. And of course, the reverse is also true. If you have a dodgy king, dodgy prime minister, dodgy president on top, who does all kind of dodgy things, that too trickles down in society. It gives license to everybody else to behave in the same way. If our leaders behave badly, you look up and think, they're behaving badly. That must be the right way of doing things. So we end up doing the same thing. So the idea of moral leadership is so important for whether we're going to have successful societies or not. So this is the example of the ancient king of India, or Magadha at that time, who was a stream enterer. Ajahn Brahm has sometimes joked that maybe that would be a good idea. Maybe we should get Ajahn Brahm to stand for Prime Minister of Australia. Is that a good idea? It's very interesting. I think it would be a very different kind of leadership from what you see here. It would be very, very fascinating to see that. But I think the problem is that it's very difficult to get elected as a Buddhist monk. Anyway, I think one of the things that we have seen around the world is that Buddhist monks or Buddhist monastics and politics is not a very good idea. Far better to stay out, and then you actually have far more moral authority when you are kind of slightly above the politics. Yeah, that is much easier to have moral authority in that case. Yeah. So that is my number one exhibit. Yeah, this is King Bimbisara from ancient India. Number two exhibit, and this is King Ashoka, the very famous King Ashoka. Have you all heard of King Ashoka? Yeah, most of you have heard of King Ashoka? Yeah, very, very famous. One of the most famous kings or monarchs in world history, basically. That's basically the reality of it. And he came to power maybe about 150 years after the Buddha, perhaps, after the Buddha passed away. Some people say a little bit more. And when he came to power, India had gone through a long process of the kingdoms kind of joining and being joined by warfare, starting in Magadha, then gradually expanding. And at this point, when he came to power, the north of India was already a massive empire. Really, really large. It stretched almost from east to west of the Indian subcontinent, almost going as far south as Sri Lanka, but not quite. And then north, up to including things like today's Pakistan and Afghanistan. A massive empire. And what do you think happens when he gets to the throne? What do you think happens when a king gets newly to the throne? What do you think happens then? What happens? The first thing he says, not big enough. Yeah, law must be larger. We have to conquer more. This is kind of the problem in life. Craving never stops. We get given this massive empire. We're kind of one of the biggest empire ever in Indian history. Yeah, still not enough. We must conquer more. We must wage warfare. We must cause enormous suffering for the people of India so we can expand our empire with a few more square kilometers or a few more thousand square kilometers or whatever it is. So as soon as he gets onto the throne, he starts warfare. And he starts warfare with his state on the east of India known as Kalinga, Kalinga State. And in this conflict, a very, very bloody conflict, because the Kalinga state was obviously very strong, had a very powerful military, and as a consequence of this conflict, hundreds of thousands of people died, according to the documents that we have left from that. I think some of those documents are basically inscriptions that exist that were done by Ashoka himself at that time. So I think the idea is that several hundreds of thousands of people died. And of course, once you have hundreds of thousands of people have died, and you feel responsible for that, after all, you are the king, yeah? You need to get out there, you need to kind of expand your empire. Of course, he felt tremendous remorse as a consequence afterwards. This again actually shows, I think, quite a good character, because a bad character doesn't even feel remorse. So the very fact that you feel remorse is a very positive thing in this particular context. But before I talk about that, as an aside, I was recently at one of the retreats. I was teaching a sutta called the Ratapala Sutta, which is a very nice little sutta, and I shall maybe give a talk about here that sutta one of these days, because it's a very beautiful sutta found in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings of the Buddha. And in the Ratapala Sutta is this this young man called Ratapala. He has gone forth, he's become a monk, yeah, he's shaved his hair, put on the robes, looks perhaps a little bit like me, and Venerable Sumangala over here, and goes forth, becomes an arahant, comes back to visit his parents. There's a very interesting thing that happens when the arahant meets his parents. Yeah, can you imagine what it's like when the arahant is a fully awakened person. Imagine the arahant coming back home, meeting his parents, what happens? Quite interesting, right? Because his parents are still worldly. They are still like the way we were before. But the arahant, he's completely changed. But I'm not going to tell you now. This is just a kind of a whetting your appetite for the next talk that's going to be on the Ratapala Sutta. So this is just kind of teasing you a little bit. But then what happens? After he's met his parents, very interesting, right, the meeting with the parents. So once he has done that, he goes off to a park near the city called Tullakotita, and he stays there, and he goes, sits down in this park, and this park happens to belong to a king, King Kauravya. And as Ratnapala is there, King Kauravya comes out to his park, and he sees this monk sitting at the foot of a tree. King Kauravya is already really old, kind of 80 years old or something, whereas Ratnapala is still quite young. So he looks at this Ratnapala. What is the story here? This young man, you know, sitting at the root of a tree. So he goes up to this young man and then asks him a few questions. And the first thing he kind of says is, well, you know, you are young, for goodness sake. This is the wrong time to become a monk. You know, when you get old maybe, yeah? When you are sick and you can't kind of make any money anymore and all your relatives are dead, that's the right time to become a monk, not when you're young. Yeah, and so what on earth made you go forth when you were young? And this sutta, the most important part of the sutta, is Ratnapala explaining to him what were the reasons why he went forth while still young. The point, of course, is that the Buddha's teaching is such. It is so powerful. It shows an alternative way of looking at reality. That whether you are young or old or middle-aged or male or female or rich or poor, whatever you are, still it is far better to go forth, practice that teaching, than to live any other kind of life. So he's really interested. What is going on? Yeah, you had everything. Rich family, good upbringing, good education. You are young, you had a wife, everything you had, and you gave it all up to become a monk. Either you are completely nuts, or you have seen something worthwhile seeing. So I want to find out which one. Are you nuts, or have you seen something profound? And then there's four summaries of the Dhamma that Ratnapala tells the king. And one of the summaries of the Dhamma is that he says, the world is incomplete, insatiate, a slave to craving. Yeah, the world is incomplete, insatiate, slave to craving. By the way, the fact that the world is insatiate, I think that probably shows us that Mick Jagger had some idea about Buddhism. Yeah, can't get no satisfaction, right? That's kind of exactly the same thing you find in the suttas. And Mick Jagger is saying exactly the same thing here in his in his heyday. So maybe Mick Jagger was a kind of closet Buddhist. I'm not sure about that, but it's a possibility. I don't think so, actually, but you're kind of stretching our imagination a little bit. He says, so this is kind of the summary of the Dhamma, yeah? And then the king says, I don't understand. What do you mean? This is, you know, three words, you know, insatiate, incomplete, a slave to craving. What does it mean? And then Ratnapala says to this king, well, king, you are already the ruler of a big country. Yeah. But if a reliable man came to you from the north and says, there is another big country to the north that is very rich, full of gold and silver, lots of people, lots of grain, lots of all kind of things. Yeah. Kind of stuff that people want. Would you conquer it? Of course I would conquer it, says the king. And if another man came from the south and said exactly the same thing, would you conquer that too? Of course you would conquer that too. And from the east, and from the west, and from overseas, and from anywhere, would you conquer it? Of course. And then Ratnapala says, well, this is what the Buddha meant by the world is insatiate, it is incomplete, it is a slave to craving. Yeah, there is no end. It doesn't matter how much you have. There is no end. I usually like to say, if you have the whole planet, it's not going to be enough. If you have the whole solar system, it's not going to be enough. If you have the whole galaxy, what do you mean, only one galaxy? I want more galaxies. Yeah, and I think this is probably the idea why they came up with the idea of multiverses. Have you heard about the idea of the multiverse? The idea that one universe, yeah, is not enough. You have many, many universes. And I think it was craving that made that multiverse idea, because one universe was not enough. More universes are required. And this may sound silly, but actually there is something very profound to that. Very profound, because we're always trying to fill up the gap the hole inside of us, the itch inside of us called craving. We're trying to fill it up with external things. And external things can never fill it up. So we're always seeking for more, more, more. And so is King Ashoka. King Ashoka is doing exactly the same thing. Here he is. He has the biggest empire in Indian history. He says, not enough. Now we're going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. And in the process, we will gain the Kalinga country as well, just to make sure that we have, you know, enough land. So that's just a little bit of a detour, just to kind of show you what is going on here in kings' minds. We may wonder why these kings are so crazy, but they're not actually crazy. It's just an extension of the craving that is already inside of us. That craving writ large, if you like. This is what we're seeing there. So then, King Ashoka has remorse. And good on him for having remorse. Good on him for not being one of these really scallywag people who are completely remorseless. And then he starts to search for an alternative solution to this. Get away from his remorse, trying to find a way to live a better life. And what he does, of course, when he does that, he comes across the Buddhist teachings and he gains faith in Buddhism. But through that process, he then starts to try to make up for the mistakes of the past. And he tries to live up to the golden standard of Buddhist governance, of Buddhist leadership. That is what he's trying to do. And he does his very best to do this. And some of the things that he does, King Ashoka, and these things again are written down. You can find them on the very famous Ashokan pillars. I don't know if you've ever been to India. If you've been to India, you will have seen probably the Ashokan pillars. These massive stone pillars, sometimes 10 meters high, and they have inscriptions on them. Or they may be large rocks or something like that. So these inscriptions are 2,300 years old and engraved by Ashoka. And there, on these inscriptions, he talks about his deeds, the sort of things that he did, and the kind of life that he lived. The sort of things that he talks about, for example, looking after people and animals by building little hospitals and clinics, by supplying medicine, by digging wells for water, by planting trees to shade people and animals. So looking after the population, being generous, being kind, being compassionate. He talks about abolishing capital punishment, killing people for their crimes. So he abolishes that, which is quite remarkable. We are still kind of striving in our present world in many countries whether we should have a capital punishment or not. He was one of the very first, probably, to abolish capital punishment. It's the wrong way to treat a criminal. You're not going to solve anything by killing them in return. Crime is never going to be solved by revenge. There must be a better way of solving criminality in this world. What else does he do? He talks about having respect for mother and father. He talks about having respect for other religions. He is a Buddhist. But just because he is a Buddhist, he doesn't say everybody has to be a Buddhist. In fact, what he says that our own spiritual maturity is shown by the degree of respect that we show to other religions. Very beautiful again. Instead of fighting other religions, it's this beautiful tolerance. And this kind of tolerance, I think, is one of the trademarks of Buddhism, that we actually have that tolerance to other religions as well. And one of the beautiful trademarks, and that's why there has been fairly little, not zero, but very, very little wars fought in the name of Buddhism throughout history here. So these are some of the things that he did. And as a consequence of that, Buddhism became very powerful in India. From the time of Ashoka, for about 5 centuries afterwards, Buddhism was probably the most powerful religion in India for 5 centuries. It overtook the Brahmanism and the Hinduism. And then eventually, of course, it petered out and Hinduism kind of came back again. But for about 5 centuries, maybe a little bit more, Buddhism was the most powerful religion in India. How do we know that? And again, we know that from inscriptions. The number of inscriptions made by Buddhists compared to the number of inscriptions you find done by non-Buddhists, by Hindus and by Brahmins and these sort of things. So very, very powerful. And what this shows us, it shows us another principle of Buddhist governance, and that is the principle of kindness. Govern from kindness. Govern by supporting your people, not by punishing them too much if they make mistakes, but actually giving criminals the benefit of the doubt and supporting them in such a way that we can overcome criminality and problems in our society. So the Ashokan way of ruling, again, very interesting from a point of view of Buddhist governance. So morality at the top, yeah? Kindness at the top. These are two of the important things. So those are two of, I think, the kind of very interesting examples of how to do things in the world. I will now tell you another example, which is a little bit not so nice. Yeah, it's good to talk about. I don't know if it is. Is it good to talk about the negative things as well? It's nice to keep the atmosphere nice and bright, but I think sometimes we need to talk about the negative side as well, because it kind of gives us an idea why the negative things happen. And this is this particular negative thing. This is something that you find in the history of Sri Lanka. It's a very interesting interesting thing. The history of Sri Lanka is full of Buddhist kings. Yeah, starting from the time when Buddhism first came there until very recently. You had the kings of Kandy. That kind of the last one was in the 19th century sometime. Lots of Buddhist kings. And as in all countries, some kings are really good. Some are not so good. Most of them were Buddhist. A few were not actually Buddhist as well in Sri Lankan history. But the particular king that I'm interested in, I'm not even 100% sure of his name, but I think his name is Duttagamani, very famous king in early Sri Lanka. And this king, Duttagamani, he, like most kings do, he also fought a war. And the war he fought was against, who do you think it was against? Tamils, right? Isn't that interesting how things always repeat themselves? So in Sri Lanka, there's always been this kind of underlying problem between the Buddhists and the Tamils, always been there. So this goes back 2,300 years, yeah? So we should not be surprised that even today there might be some problems there. So what happened with Duttagamani? He was fighting the Tamils, and after, again, a vast number of people dying, he also felt incredible remorse because of this, which again is a really good quality, yeah? You're trying to do the right thing, and as a righteous person, you then feel remorse when you've done something that you know isn't quite right. So what happened then? What happened then, because he felt remorse, he had these monks come to him, yeah? This is a passage which is quite notorious. It's one of the very few passages in the Pali scriptures which have this kind of strong notoriety in them. And what he then tells the monks, oh, I feel so much remorse, I feel so bad because of this. And then the monks tell him, this is a story. I don't know if this actually happened or not. It is very unclear. Some aspects of this story are obviously not true. So there is obviously some problems with this particular story. But what the monks tell him, after he has killed thousands of people with his military, they tell the king, you have only killed 1.5 person. And the king looks at them, what do you mean I've only killed 1.5 person? And then they say, there was one person who kept the 5 precepts. That is half a person. There was another one you killed who kept the 5 precepts and had gone to the three refuges. That was one person. So you only killed 1.5 person. The rest don't count. Yeah. And supposedly, according to this story, these were supposed to be arahants. So because they were supposed to be arahants, and because they were supposed to be awakened beings, of course their word would have been extraordinarily powerful. Everybody would have listened to that. But also, it goes without saying that they couldn't possibly have been arahants. No arahant will ever tell you such a blatant falsehood, because it goes against everything that we know from the Buddha's teachings, that you can't even kill, not even supposed to kill animals. But what happened was that this story then got written down. It got written down in a very famous chronicle of Sri Lankan history called the Mahavamsa, which chronicles the Sri Lankan history over a long period of time. And somehow it got in there, yeah, among all the jewels of Buddhism. There's this one paragraph that is has this very unfortunate kind of slant to it. Nobody knows whether it's really true. Obviously there is some falsehood because the Arahants didn't really teach it, but still somehow it made its way into this Mahavamsa. And this, of course, when something like that has made its way into a scripture, it very often has repercussions down in history. And this is one of the reasons why I'm telling of this particular event, because to show you the repercussions that it has had later on. Whether anything really was wrong at that time, it certainly has had repercussions later. And this is kind of the worrying thing about these things. And I will talk a bit about how to avoid that for the future. It's one of the reasons I want to bring that up. So that is a little bit about the some of the historical context and historical background for how rulership and governance has happened in Buddhist history with Buddhist monarchs, etc. Now let's move on to the present day here. And I mentioned at the very beginning of my talk about the king of Thailand, yeah, and the kind of rulership. He was the king for Thailand for, I think, about 70 years before he passed away about a year ago. And he was loved by the Thai people. He was put in very, very high esteem by the Thai people. And it's obvious that he must have done a lot of good in Thailand. You don't get that kind of reputation unless you do a lot of good for the Thai people. And he was famous for that too. He was famous for traveling around the countryside, looking at how people were living, and giving them moral support, and also very often support through how the country was governed. He was not really directly involved with government, but obviously he had influence, certainly a lot of moral authority in Thailand. And one of the stories, and this is a story that Ajahn Brahm tells, I don't know, I hope he hasn't told this here recently, because then you get even more Ajahn Brahm stories on top of all the ones that he's telling already. But so I hope this is a long time. But this is one of Ajahn Brahm's stories, and it's a very touching story about what happened in Thailand while he was a monk there in the mid-1970s. And of course, anything that happened on the large political scale in Thailand at that time or afterwards, it would have been sanctioned at the very least by the king. The king would have given his okay. The king would in some ways have been behind that. And the story Ajahn Brahm tells in the mid-1970s, Ajahn Brahm became a monk in Thailand in 1974. So soon after he had become a monk in Thailand, he stayed with Ajahn Chah in the Ubon province, Ubon Ratchathani. And Ubon Ratchathani happens to be closer to Hanoi than it is to Bangkok. Yeah, so very close to all the fighting that was happening at that time, the Vietnam War and all of that. And lots of problems in Laos that became communist, in Cambodia which became communist. And there was a big communist insurgency also in Thailand. And everybody was afraid that Thailand also was going to become communist. So there was lots of politics going on and all kinds of things. But what is interesting about this is how this insurgency of the communists was tackled by the Thai government, and how the king actually looked upon this insurgency, what they actually did. And one of the first things they did, instead of fighting power with power, they were using soft power instead. And one of the great things they did was going, as we often know, is the right way to solve issues. Go to the source of the problem. Why are people becoming communist? Why are they becoming communist to the point where they're willing to fight their own people and kill so many people for this, for their cause? And of course, poverty at that time was very rife in the northeast of Thailand. So what they started to do was to help to rebuild some of the important infrastructure of the area. One of the things they built, and this was specifically the king apparently, he built little dams for the people. So it was easier for the farmers to irrigate the fields. So instead of having one crop a year, they could have two crops a year. Yeah, and of course that boosts your revenue massively if you can have two crops a year rather than just a single crop in the year. Also, because the economy was booming at this time, people got more consumer goods. Yeah, simple things like radios, their houses improved, their standard of living improved, generally speaking. Yeah. So this was the first thing they did. They went to the root causes of the problem. Why is it that these people are so willing to fight their own people for the sake of kind of communist ideology? The second thing that they did was that they created an amnesty. Anyone who gives up the communist cause are welcome back into their families, back to the universities. Many of the people, as often is the case with students at the time, come back to universities, come back to your regular job. Complete amnesty for those people who give up the communist cause. And that, of course, is the idea of forgiveness. Instead of punishing the criminals, we give them the opportunity to look at things in a different way. And gradually, because of the amnesty, because the standard of livings were improving, more and more of these people, communist people, they gave up the cause and came back to the ordinary society again. And of course, it was very tempting. Being a communist at that time in Thailand, living in the jungles, living in the mountains, was tremendous hardship. It was very difficult to do that because often infested with malaria and all kind of illnesses. So it was very tempting to come back to a village. And gradually, the communist armies dwindled until towards the end, there was hardly anyone left except for the leaders of the armies. And then the Thai government, this would have been the time perhaps to kind of go after the leaders, and kind of get rid of the leaders and kind of extinguish the communist cause. But instead of doing that, they also gave amnesty to the leaders, but with a twist. And the twist was that they realized that these leaders of the communism, these were very motivated people who were very skilled in leadership and all of these kind of things. So instead of just giving them amnesty, let's give them jobs in the government that accords with their skills as administrators, as leaders in society. So they brought them back, understood that these people have something to offer society, gave them government jobs, and 20 years after this happened, some of those people had risen to the rank of ministers in the Thai government. And this to me shows you in a very beautiful way how you apply the ideas of Buddhist ideas of governing in the right way, by being kind, using principles of Dhamma, by forgiving the faults of others around you, using the qualities that people have in your own society, and then rebuilding it on that basis. And then, of course, one of the powerful things about that is that you destroy all the underlying animosity. How can you have animosity when there's forgiveness? There's no lingering animosity or anger there anymore because you have amnesty and forgiveness all around. This shows you the power of forgiveness rather than the power of revenge in our society. It's a very beautiful way of doing things. If you take revenge, if we fight war with war, then you have that famous saying in the Dhammapada that, hatred never ends through hatred. Hatred only ends through love. This is an eternal law. Beautiful saying from the Dhammapada, and it's so true. If you meet aggression with aggression, it just creates more ill will, more negativity. It goes on and on and on forever. It is just so obvious when you think about it. Only by withdrawing that, granting forgiveness, moving on, the problem can be solved at its root. And this is what happened in Thailand at that time. So this is an example from the modern era, how governance works. And of course, the Thai king, he tried precisely to govern according to Buddhist principles. But I also want to have a quick look at the other side of the coin, and that is the problems that we've been seeing in Burma especially over the last couple of years. But actually, it has been a conflict, it has been simmering for several centuries actually. It's a very old problem, and it's very difficult to give it full justice to really understand what is going on. So all I want to focus on is the Buddhist impact here. What is the Buddhist influence? How has Buddhism contributed to this particular refugee crisis that you find in Burma right now, with the military kind of seemingly cracking down on these Rohingyas in a very harsh way? What is going on? And this became quite clear to me when recently I read a transcript of a talk given by a very famous monk in Burma. Yeah, sometimes you have to get very close to the action to be able to see what is really going on. And this monk is actually one of the very famous monks in Burma. He gave a talk to the military, yeah. Apparently the talk went on for 3 hours. Yeah, and of course because he's famous and the military will take heed of what he's saying. And one of the things that he says in this talk, and this was one of the things that was so concerning and so problematic, and you can start to see why these kind of crises, why they roll on and why there is no solution. One of the things he said in this talk, he referred back to that passage I was talking about before that is found in the Mahavamsa. Yeah, the passage where I said that you haven't killed anyone, you only killed 1.5 person, because all of these others, they're not really people. Yeah, they don't really count because they're not keeping the 5 precepts. They haven't gone for refuge to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. He recited that passage, and it was obvious when he read that what he was saying to the military, actually, what you're doing is not really a problem. Yeah. And then it occurred to me, I didn't really know what was going on. Sometimes you have to see these things very closely. Then it became very clear to me that there is a problem here also from the Buddhist side. It's not just that the military is bad, but actually how we present the Buddhist teachings has gone completely wrong. And because it has gone completely wrong, this notorious, infamous passage from the Mahavamsa was used to justify something that cannot be justified if you look at real Buddhist scriptures. So what can we learn from this? And what we can learn from this is that if we are going to have proper Buddhist governance, we have to be very careful where we take our inspiration. If you take your inspiration from the wrong place, from the wrong kind of scriptures, yeah, and these, the wrong kind of scriptures are the scriptures that are not really, don't really come from the Buddha, but come from somewhere else. We don't really know exactly where they come from. When we take it from the wrong place, from some anonymous source, some person who sent something in history, then we are in danger of going wrong. The Mahavamsa is a collection of history. It's written by anonymous people. Nobody really knows where it comes from. However, if we do always make sure that we check everything with the word of the Buddha, we go back to what the Buddha said, 5 precepts, yeah, not killing. If you go back to that, there is absolutely no way that you're going to be able to justify killing other people, using the military in a negative way in this way. So please, whenever you hear something that sounds a bit dodgy, when you hear something that sounds a bit as if it is not really Buddhist, check the sources. Where does it come from? Who said this? Does the Buddha agree with this? Yeah. And if the Buddha agrees and the Buddha says this is correct, then you are on the right track. Yeah. By the way, I'm not blaming anyone here. I don't want to blame Myanmar or Burma or blame anyone else. All I want to do is show how certain things kind of happen in history, yeah? It can happen to anyone, anywhere. But because these are Buddhist countries, I think it is very useful to look at those examples just to see how things actually work out and how they don't work out. So there's 4 things here that the Buddha talks about, just to summarize a little bit. 4 things that he talks about when it comes to right governance, the right way of leadership. And the first thing is that leaders themselves need to be moral. Yeah, when leaders are moral, it trickles down in society and everybody else is affected in a very beautiful way. And what that means maybe for our modern world is that when we elect leaders, maybe we should elect them on the basis of their moral integrity. Yeah, look at them. Not so much on all the other things, on all the promises which often don't get fulfilled anyway. Yeah, look instead at the morality of people. One of the interesting things, if you look at the ancient Roman candidates, when they had candidates for the Senate in ancient Rome, the word candidate comes actually from that Latin word candid, which means white. Yeah, and that was because the candidates, they wore white when they were being elected for office as a sign of purity. And this, I think, is one of the most powerful foundations for being a good leader is that you have that degree of morality. Then society tends to stabilize. Everything, everyone else is affected in a good way. Even if you don't do anything else in office, at least you're going to have a fairly stable and peaceful country here. Even if you mess up the economy and everything else. Sometimes I think we put far too much emphasis on the blooming economy. What does it matter if the economy grows by 1.5% or 2%? Yeah, it's kind of so narrow-minded in my opinion. Isn't it far more important that we have a society that is stable and friendly and kind and all of these kind of things? I think we kind of get our priorities so wrong sometimes. So don't worry so much about the economic kind of credentials or whatever. Sometimes far more important that we have purity and morality at the top of our secular hierarchies. Number one. Number two is the idea of kindness. Yeah, the idea that people on top are kind to the people below. And of course, we have that already to a large extent in many countries around the world. The idea of the welfare state is the idea of supporting people that have a hard time supporting themselves. And I think this kindness is so important, and it's something that we should really develop in all our societies, whether we are democracies, or whether we are monarchies, or whatever it is. That kindness also trickles down. People feel that. And in my experience, if we are kind towards others, if society is kind towards the individuals in that society, if we support the disadvantaged, then, of course, what happens is that those people will feel that they are supported, and they will tend to, most people will tend then to act appropriately as a consequence. That is my experience with kindness. When I feel that people are kind to me, I want to reciprocate. I want to live up to their goodwill. I don't want to be bad in return. And I believe the vast majority of people are just like that. Not everyone, of course. There's always going to be some people who are not affected by that kind of kindness. But I think the majority always is. Kindness is so important. And the third one is how to deal with things like uprisings and crime in our society. And again, the Buddhist principle here is to forgive. Yeah, to let go of the past. Give the criminals a second opportunity. How can we employ them in our government? Yeah, some people might say they're already employed in our government in the wrong way. But how can we kind of lift them up, help them out of the problem? From a Buddhist point of view, people are criminals for a reason, because they have been conditioned that way. That they can be reconditioned again. Maybe not everyone, but the vast majority can be reconditioned to be good members of our society. Our penal system, our prisons, should be places of rehabilitation, where we try to put people back on the right track again. Yeah, there shouldn't be places of revenge. There shouldn't be places where we put people down and make their life miserable just for the sake of it. But often it is like that. Often we want revenge. But that's not the Buddhist attitude. We should try to help them, to put them back on their feet, so they can become good and upstanding members of society again. And it's very interesting, if you look at the penal systems around the world, those places where they place a lot of emphasis on rehabilitation, the re-offending rates are so much lower than they are in those places where you don't put emphasis on that, where the idea of revenge is more prominent in those societies. Yeah, massive differences. Because I happen to be Norwegian by birth, and as I look at some of the statistics in Norway, and this is one of the beautiful things they have got right in Norway. They have kind of had a penal system which is based on the idea of rehabilitation, and the reoffending rates are just absolutely so low. And what a wonderful thing that is. And I think that is something that we should, is right also from a Buddhist point of view, to kind of draw down, bring people back again, beautiful way of forgiveness and support. And the last thing that is so important is that when leaders and those people in power, that they have something higher to look to, a place where they can go to find inspiration, understanding, where they can go and ask questions. What is right in this world? What is wrong? How should I live my life? Yeah, just like the ancient kings of India and of Sri Lanka, whatever, they would often go to the Sangha, to those monks and nuns, and perhaps lay people who were specially attained and pure, and ask them questions. Not to those so-called arahants that Duttagamani went to. It must have been completely wrong information for that poor king that he got, very bad advice. But the really good ones, yeah. And then you get some good advice on what is right and wrong in this world. Have some kind of higher power, something above you. Don't not feel that you are on top of the hierarchy. Once you are on top of the hierarchy, then it becomes almost like an unbearable burden on your shoulders. It's so important to have something we can look up to. Yeah, and in the end, all Buddhists look up to the Buddha. The Buddha passed away 2,500 years ago. That is the final reference, the final standard for all of us. And it's very interesting, if you look at some of the examples in history, Winston Churchill, apparently, yeah, one of the great leaders of modern times, at least great in some respects, and some of the perhaps not so great, but he apparently had a statue of the Buddha next to his bed. Yeah. Why did he have that? Why was it there? And I don't actually know. I don't think he says anywhere why he had it there. Of course, he may just have liked Buddhist art. That's a possibility. But it's equally possible that he actually had it there, because any Buddha statue that is well made reflects some of the qualities of awakening. Yeah, they look peaceful. They have a sense of wisdom about them. There's a sense of kindness, a kindly smile on the face or whatever. That when you have it on your bedstead, it's almost as if you are in the presence of a higher power. So I think it is quite possible that even Winston Churchill, yeah, probably looked to this as a higher power, something to draw inspiration from in difficult times. And what is interesting, this is perhaps for me one of the most surprising things of all, and this is one of the, straight from the suttas again, straight from the word of the Buddha, and this is where the Buddha himself, he says, what should I honor? What should I respect? Yeah. And then he says, because anyone who lives in this world, if you don't have something in this world that you can honor and respect, that person lives in suffering. It's the Buddha said that, for goodness sake. Yeah, and then he looks around the world and he sees that there is nobody more awakened than he actually is. So because there is nobody else who he can look up to in terms of people, it means that there is no person that he can honor and respect. And then the thought occurs to him, what I should honor and respect is this very Dhamma, this very teaching, this very truth that I have awakened to. Let me honor and respect that. So even the Buddha, yeah, even the Buddha says it is so important to have something in our life, something to look up to, something more, something powerful, because it lifts us up, it gives us hope that there is something in this world that really is powerful and very, very useful. Yeah, and the same thing in our lives. If all we have is just an ordinary life with family and job and all these kind of things, sometimes it seems kind of pointless. What is it all about? But it gives meaning to our life. It gives purpose. It gives a sense that there is something more in this world than the ordinary, dreary, sometimes dreary, sometimes not so dreary things of ordinary life. Something that we can look up to as more powerful, more beautiful. Something that we too can aspire for in the depth of our hearts, eventually moving in the same direction. Yeah, it's so important. And it's so important also for our leaders. And this, of course, is true in monastery, it's true in the Buddha society, it's true in countries, true in families, true everywhere. When we have that, everything advances in the right way. So that is those four qualities that are often talked about when it comes to leadership in the suttas. I want to talk about two other qualities very, very briefly, not too much, because otherwise we're going to be gone for too long. And these two other qualities are how we actually make decisions in Buddhism. Yeah, what kind of how we go about such things? How, for example, how do we elect people? How do we get the right people in government and this kind of stuff? And of course, one of the very interesting things here is how the Buddha established the monastic order. I've talked about that particular thing here before. But the way he established the monastic order was based on the idea of absolute democracy. Yeah, so whenever you are in the Sangha part of the monastic order and you make a decision, everyone has to agree. Everyone has to say, not everyone, nobody can object. Yeah, if one person objects, there's no way you can go forward. Yeah? And the Buddha himself took that idea from what was at that time one of the models of government in India. The Vajrayana Republic, one of the famous republics in India at that time, had that kind of democracy. People would come together, they would assemble in the Sabha. The Sabha is the Indian word for kind of assembly hall. If you go to India today, the Indian parliament is called the Sabha. Yeah, isn't that quite cool? I find that really cool. It's kind of you can see the lines of history, yeah? The ancient word in Pali, going back to the time of the Buddha, it was called Sabha already. Go to India today, still called the Sabha. It's kind of beautiful to see these lines in history. It connects Buddhism, it connects the Buddhist teachings to everything else in a very powerful way. It makes it very authentic when you see these things. But anyway, so the Buddha established the democracy in the Sangha on exactly the same lines as an existing democracy that already existed in India at that time. Every monk, yeah, regardless of how long you've been in the monastery, regardless of your seniority, regardless of how old you are, regardless of how wise you are, regardless of whether you're an arahant or a scallywag, yeah, there's a big gap between arahants and scallywags. Yeah? So regardless of all that, you have a vote in the Sangha. Huh? And you may think, that is impractical, you may think. How's that going to work out? It's a recipe for gridlock. Yeah? But no, it is not a recipe for gridlock. It is a recipe for a very beautiful way of governing an organization like the Sangha. Because what it means is that if there is one person who objects, it means you have to ask them. If there's two people, three people object, you have to ask them, why are you objecting? Then you have to find some kind of compromise so that everybody's interest is taken into account. Then you can move forward and make a decision on the issue. Yeah? And what it means is that instead of having a majority oppressing a minority, which democracies can sometimes be a bit like, yeah, well, we won, now we're going to do what we like, you have to get everybody on board and everybody gets something out of these decisions. It's a very beautiful way of running an institution. And when it is done well, it works remarkably well. At Bodhinyana Monastery, we try to live like this, and basically it works. Sometimes we argue a little bit. Should I say this? Maybe I shouldn't say it. It's embarrassing. I said, what do you think, Venerable Sumangalo? Sometimes, of course, it's unavoidable that sometimes you have a little bit of an argument. But at the end of the day, we come to an agreement based on a common interest of everyone. It's so beautiful and so powerful way of doing things. And I think maybe that would be a way of running perhaps even the Buddhist society here. Going back to those ancient principles. See if you can find that common denominator whenever you make a decision, when everybody has an input, everybody's interest is taken into account. And if you can't find that commonality, well then you just have to move on somehow. So that is one of those things. The other things that is very powerful in the way the Buddha established the Sangha is the fact that it is so decentralized. Every monastery is responsible for its own affairs, yeah? There is no hierarchy, it's completely flat. There is not even an abbot. No abbot even, yeah? Everybody is basically on the same level. So you may think, what about Ajahn Brahm? Isn't he the abbot? So Ajahn Brahm is not original, he's not the real kind of, you know, he is already part of this hierarchical thing that has arisen through Buddhist history. But originally, there were not even any abbots in the monastery. That's how flat the structure was. Everybody really had an equal say. It is not exactly true, because of course, if you have been a monk for a long time or a nun for a long time, you have a certain natural authority. If you have a lot of powerful spiritual qualities, again, you have a very natural authority. People just listen to you as a matter of course because of those powers that you have. But that is a natural authority. It's not an authority that you grasp and take and you assume because you feel that you should be listened to. And that kind of authority is perfectly acceptable. But even then, ultimately, everyone has a say in that kind of system. But again, there is no hierarchy there, yeah? And there's something very beautiful about having organizations that have no hierarchy. I think one of the biggest problems in our world are hierarchies. In the Buddhist world, in the monastic orders these days, incredibly hierarchies. Sometimes these hierarchies are deliberately modeled on the Catholic Church. Yeah, isn't that quite amazing? Buddhist hierarchy is modeled on the Catholic Church, even though Buddhism is so different from Christianity. You wonder what the point is, how it's possible to model something on when a religion is so different. It makes no sense to my mind to do that. So instead of doing that, we go back to the early suttas. Take away the hierarchies. When you take away the hierarchies, what you're doing, you are reducing the scope for corruption, for abuse of power, and all of these things massively. Hierarchies are automatically tend to create corruption and problems, because wherever there is power, there are going to be people fighting for that power, because power always allows you to get things your way, and that is what we all want, yeah? So once you create the hierarchy, you get ambition. Ambition of climbing the hierarchy, using that power, and using the results of that power as a consequence. Flat structures are far less easy to abuse those in the same way. So this was the foresight of the Buddha when he established the Sangha 2,500 years ago. And I think that we would do really well to remember these things. Try to establish our own organizations, wherever they are, even in our society, but starting closer to home, starting with the monasteries that we have here, starting with the Buddha Society, starting with our own environment around us, and try to get as close as possible to these beautiful Buddhist ideals. And I think they are very powerful. And as always, if we listen to the Buddha and we do things the way he recommended, I think it is very difficult to go far wrong with the way we establish things. Okay, that is enough for tonight. So there's a little talk for you on Buddhist governance and good Buddhist leadership. Okay, so before we take the questions from overseas, anyone here like to ask any questions or anything here? Any comments by anyone? Yes, Stephen, just 1 second, Stephen, we'll get to the microphone. You can use that one.
Ajahn, thank you for a wonderful talk. What's the best way to deal with a conflict when you think two people are intractable?
When two people are really intractable? I think in the end, you have to either you just have to wait very often, just not do very much at all. I think that's kind of one of the things, and just kind of allow things to sit there. And usually things may look intractable, but usually down the line there's a certain opening, something opens up, a possibility arises. Very often if you have a very strong conflict, one of the people would eventually leave, right? Because it is unbearable to live too close to somebody you are in close conflict with. So I think the often best thing is just to wait and see, try of course, the just kind of standard ways of conflict resolution, whatever it is, but eventually just wait. But of course, you know, ideally, the way we should live in a Buddhist society, in a monastery, we should live with those things that create harmony. And those things that create harmony, the Buddha always says, is having a sense of metta, kindness for each other, generosity towards each other. And it is actually, I would say, in a Buddhist society like this, it actually is quite easy to have metta and compassion for the people around you, because people here are just very basically beautiful people, yeah? Everyone who comes here has good intentions, they want to do the right thing, they are not perfect, and because they're not perfect, there will be conflicts inevitably. Really, there is so much goodness going on there. So by trying a little bit, by kind of stretching ourselves a little bit, it should be possible to have a degree of metta and friendliness towards everyone, every single person who comes to this place. Okay, anyone else like to say anything? No? Nobody wants to speak? Okay. You're allowed to speak. Even if you have stupid questions, you're allowed to speak, right? It's okay. because stupid questions are usually not all that stupid at all. That's usually what happens. So anyway, so if you don't have any stupid questions or any other questions, oh, over there, okay, good. Is it a stupid question or not a stupid question? Yeah.
What do you think is the main, what causes the extreme incompatibility between the Tamils and the Buddhists of Sri Lanka and elsewhere? We have this in Bhutan and Nepal, and now it's happening in the north of Thailand. What is the main cause, please?
Okay, well, I think the main cause, okay, it's very often very complex situation. There's many, many factors. You know, the situation in Burma has been going on for many centuries. The first Rohingyas came into Burma maybe 200 or 300 years ago, and apparently they came in, according to the Burmese history books, as a consequence of a deal that was made by the king that was then Bangladesh and a king who was in Burma. So there was a deal by which these people were moved into Burma. Yeah? So there are really good historical reasons, and then of course they flare up. But I think one of the biggest problems in this is that basically the idea of what we identify with, and I talked about this here for a few weeks ago when I talked about this conflict as well. And the problem is that when we identify too strongly with Buddhism and we take it as our identity, it means that when Buddhism is threatened, we feel that we are threatened as well. Yeah, and this is one of the problems. So in Myanmar, what is happening there, I think a lot of it, if you listen to it, is very kind of nationalist rhetoric. Is Buddhism is threatened, Buddhism is going to die out. The Muslims are a problem because they are a threat to our Buddhist teachings. And because of that, we need to counteract the threat. So we identify too much with the idea of being a Buddhist. So I suggest that during that talk I gave a few weeks ago, that instead of identifying with being a Buddhist, we should identify as people who practice the Buddhist teachings instead. Once you identify with that, you can't really make that mistake, because that mistake only comes because you don't practice the Buddhist teachings. Yeah. Once you identify with the practice, kindness, compassion, understanding is always right. So this is, I think, one way of diffusing that. At least for us it is. You know, to persuade all Buddhists in the world, this is the right way, I think is a very tall order. But at least we can take that on board for our own practice right here at the Buddhist Society, which I think already is a very good start. But that, I think, is one of the underlying problems there. Identity, sense of self, I am, yeah? I just got this question from Sanat over here. He asked me this question about I am. And I think this idea, I am, actually is part of the problem. The sense of self is ultimately what kind of leads to all these kind of problems and things. Happy with that? Not quite? No?
Yeah?
Not usually it's not all Buddhist, yeah? Usually they are not Buddhist. The Tamils in Sri Lanka are not Buddhist. They would be Hindus normally, yeah? And in the problem in Burma is between Muslims and Buddhists, yeah?
And in North India, it's
Yeah, well, this is the thing. Religion is one of the very powerful identity markers in people, yeah? It says a lot about us. And because there are such strong identities, we tend to clash across religions, regardless of, you know, whether we speak the same language or whatever else. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Yes.
I like to give a few examples. It is not just the religion, it is the resources sharing that's the problem. I'll give you two examples. I don't know if you agree or not. When truckies try to drive along the Bodhinyana monastery road, you all almost went to the courts to stop it because that sound disturbs your meditation.
Yeah.
From their point of view, they are trying to make their living for their generations, but in your point, it disturbs your meditation.
Yeah.
So it's okay.
Yeah.
Australia is a big country, they can find a different route. Okay. The other one, when somebody tries to make a quarry close to the Bodhinyana monastery, you try to stop it or stop it, because that dynamites and noises will disturb you.
Sure.
Okay, now, we are trying to make the meditation, the living, we are trying to make the meditation.
Yeah.
So, okay, they can go to another quarry, make their money, even though they may not make much of profit. It's okay. This is a big country, they can go.
Yeah.
Assume that you have all the Bodhinyana monastery around that is the sea.
Yeah.
Just the sea, nothing else. And when people who don't have land to live come and settle in your land, you can't get and do any meditation and they push you out. Yeah. What do? You try to jump in the sea and then swim out. Well, this is the kind of this resource sharing issue that is happening in Sri Lanka, countries.
Yeah.
And then, but it has the brand of the religion of those years. But the resource sharing is the issue, main issue. Otherwise, people may not be caring that much of the religion.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Most of the people are not that religious anyway.
Mm.
But this goes under the brand. But the issue is the resource sharing.
Sure, sure. Okay. Yeah. No, that's fair enough. I don't say. You know, I'm only kind of looking at a few issues, a few ways of looking at it. Of course, I recognize that these things are very complex and there's many factors in these things. So yeah. So thank you for that. Yeah. Okay, so let's have a quick look at the from overseas. Actually, one is from Australia. This is from Satush in Australia. I am 11. Okay, 11. Wow, that's really cool. So welcome. And in the future, I have to do tests to get into different schools. Do you have any tips on not getting depressed about the tests and the future things? Okay, so the tips is not to take these things too seriously, right? It is not the end of the world. If you do really well, it's great. If you don't do so well, you will still have a life. And sometimes you enjoy your life more if you don't do so well. Sometimes if you do really well, you get railroaded down this track, go to university, get a really high demanding job, work 15 hours a day. Yeah, I know I have had some friends who were incredibly successful in business life and they have worked their bottoms off. Yeah, it's been so much work when you get into some of these companies where they have very, very high demands on you. So sometimes it doesn't matter. You do your best. That is what matters. You put in the effort. That is what matters. And when you have done your best, you can always feel good about yourself afterwards. Whether you do bad or whether you do well is not so important. You will still have a good life if you live well. If you live with integrity, with morality, with kindness, kindness is what I really mean here. If you're a kind and good person, you will still have a good life. What do you want? Do you want to be successful or do you want to be happy? What is more important? Sometimes people think success is what really matters and they throw happiness out of the window. But actually happiness is far more important. You can be successful, there's no problem with that. But certainly make sure that you are happy. And happiness does not come from passing tests. Happiness comes from being reasonable, being kind, being good, living well. That's where happiness really comes from. And then you can relax when the test comes. You can, if I do well, that's wonderful. If I don't do so well, life still goes on, and maybe I will be even happier as a result. When you look at it like that, you relax, you're likely to do better on those tests. Yeah, so that's the trick there. So good luck with your test, and please don't get depressed, because that is really not doesn't really help. But if you do, you can always come back to the talks here, listen to a few jokes. Ajahn Brahm always tells some nice jokes on these Friday night talks, and then you can lift your mood a little bit. Okay, the next one is from Sophia in Portugal. Sophia says, "Dear Ajahn, how to decide when to act and not when confronted with the problems in life? How to make the best decisions? So thank you." Okay, that's a very good question, a question that we get quite often. Because it is very important how to make decisions in life. And there's a number of ways of doing that. But one of the most important things is to make sure that when you make a decision, that you have a clear mind. Don't make any decision if you feel that you're caught up in emotions, desire, anger, or fear, or anything like that, because it's going to cloud your vision. You don't really know what is right and what is wrong when you have those things. So, very often what happens, and I heard this so many times, All we have to do is to sit down somewhere, be quiet, go on a meditation retreat, do the meditation here with the Dhammaloka crowd, yeah? It's wonderful to be able to be in Portugal, isn't it? And be able to meditate with people in Australia. Yeah. What a wonderful thing that is. It kind of makes the world really small, but in a very beautiful way, using technology in a wonderful way like that. So do that. And when you sit here, and when you actually, not literally sit here, but when you are kind of part of this, or you sit where you are, or whatever you do, sometimes you will become very peaceful and quiet in your meditation. And when that happens, that is often when the answer comes by themselves. You know, of course, that's what I have to do. And the answer tends to come by itself. Yeah, so this is one way of making decisions, one of the very important ones. Know your mind, know that you are in the right frame of mind to decide something. The other thing, which is a very useful way of thinking about decision making, is to ask yourself, what really matters in your life? If you are someone who is very serious about the Buddhist practice, yeah, and I consider myself to be such a person, when I make decisions, I try to ask myself, what is it that will improve my Buddhist practice? What is it that will increase my good qualities and lead to a decline in my bad qualities? How can I have less stupidity and anger and desires in life? Yeah? How can I have more compassion, kindness, peace, and these kind of beautiful qualities? That is what I ask myself. And then I ask myself, should I stay in this monastery or that monastery? Should I have this teacher or that teacher? Should I wear brown robes or black robes? Yeah? Actually, that question doesn't really come up. I'm just kind of making that up just for the sake of... should I... whatever, yeah? Should I take Australian citizenship? Apparently, Norway is going to open up for dual citizenship, so I might take dual citizenship soon, but only if it improves on meditation, yeah? Only then. And this is a beautiful way of thinking about life's problems. What is it? What decision will help you to move, to help you on the Buddhist path? Yeah, in the long run, not in the short run, but in the long run. And if you do that, even difficult questions you can actually solve by using that as your kind of template for resolving things. But then there's another way of solving problems, yeah, of making decisions. This is kind of Ajahn Brahm's favorite way. And he says what you should do if you have a problem, you should take a coin, you should toss the coin, yeah, and land it in your hand. And then if it is tails, you do A. If it is heads, then you do B, yeah? So you look at your coin, oh, A. Oh, no, not A. Right? And that is the whole point. When you look at that coin and you see, oh, no, not A, or you say, oh, yeah, B, you know from your emotional reaction what you actually wanted in the first place. It is a way of just helping you to decide, to see what you actually wanted. Yeah, it's kind of a cool little trick. So you can try that as well and see what happens from that. So try some of those things. I'm not sure exactly what kind of problem you have, so it also depends a little bit on the problem. But see if that helps. Last question. This is from He Hua in Malaysia. Stream entry is by listening to the Dhamma, but is Dhamma required for stream winner? Also, will stream enter achieve stream winner in this very life or next life? Thank you, Ajahn. Stream entry is by listening to Dhamma. Stream entry is not really by listening to the Dhamma. Stream entry is by understanding the Dhamma, by having insight. So it can happen while you're listening, yeah? If you're really getting into some good samadhi and you're listening to the Dhamma shortly afterwards, it can happen by that. But it doesn't have to happen like that. It can also happen just in samadhi itself. You go into deep state of meditation, you come out afterwards, then you have the insight into things. So it's not just by listening. Is jhana required? If I were you, I would put it aside. It is irrelevant. Remember that the way to awakening is the Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, the Noble Eightfold Path includes the four jhanas. So as you practice, just keep on practicing. Yeah, and as you practice, stream entry will happen there somewhere on that path, which includes the four jhanas. Whether it happens before you get to jhana or it happens after you get to jhana is irrelevant. All you have to do is practice the Noble Eightfold Path. And at some stage during that path, jhana will happen and stream entry will happen. That's all you need to know. And let them happen in the right order according to their own nature. Is it necessary? It is extremely helpful to have jhana, since it is one of the factors for awakening itself. That is really all you need to know. So that is a much better way of thinking about it. Is it necessary or not? Is kind of a, I think, the wrong way to phrase and to look at that whole issue here. Stream mentor will achieve stream winner in this life or the next life. I think maybe what you're referring to here is different types of stream entry, kind of being on the path and then having the full insight later on, and it should happen in the same life. So if you have the initial insight, the full insight of stream entry will then happen later on in the same life. Okay, so I hope that is satisfactory. If not, please come back to us later on. And now let us pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.
Sūpatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.